Hello and welcome to episode 62 of the Desi Outsiders podcast. I'm Ankita.
And I'm Meenal.
And on Women's Day, we couldn't be happier to speak to none other than Lauren C. Anderson, one of the first ever women to be selected for the FBI SWAT team. Lauren takes us through her journey from the time she was 11, when she was told that women cannot join the FBI, to now, when she's become one of the most responsible change makers in the world.
Lauren speaks to us about her views on women's safety, terrorism, and responsible change making in this world. So without further ado, let's jump right into the show. Welcome to the show, Lauren. It really is amazing to have you on the show today and be able to talk to you after such a long, long list of emails and back and forth. But thank you for taking the time to join us on our show today.
Thank you for having me. It's an absolute delight, and I've been looking forward to our conversation for some time.
And Lauren, our listeners would probably find it very interesting that we're speaking to you on International Women's Day. And I have been woman crushing on you for the longest time because you were one of the first women selected for an FBI SWAT team. Do you remember which year that was?
1984.
Awesome.
Well, we were like minus 10 years old.
That's what I tell people. I started in the FBI when I was only 9.
Speaking of which, when you were 11, you actually took a tour of the FBI headquarters with your family, and you know, you raised your hand and you asked your tour guide if girls can be FBI agents. Do you want to tell everyone what he said to you?
Yes, I would call that my first awakening of what the real world was like, as opposed to how I was raised at home, where both my mom and dad said, you can be whatever you want, you can do whatever you want. My dad always used to say to me, but always be the boss, Lauren, be the boss. So, as you say, I raised my hand, asked the tour guide if girls could be FBI agents, and his response to me, which is burned in my brain since the age of 11, was no. And I said, well, why not? And he said, because girls would spend all their time painting their nails. And that's what I got at age 11.
Oh, and what would you like to say to him today if you got the opportunity?
Actually, I thought about what I would say to him the day I got my appointment letter to the FBI when I was 26 years old. Probably most of the language I would have liked to have used isn't appropriate for a podcast. But I got that letter. I can remember standing in my kitchen in my apartment in New York City and saying, where are you now? Let me just show you now that girls can't be FBI agents. I raised my hand. I can remember standing in the kitchen. It was like in a film. I raised that letter in the air and I'm like, where are you now, Mr. Tour Guide?
I can actually picture that.
I can too. You're like my spirit animal at this point. So back then, Lauren, what was the FBI environment like? Because you were one of the first women to join. You know, did you as a woman have to, you know, fight for your corner or try and prove your merit, you know, jump through hoops?
Well, I was actually in what we termed the second generation of women who came in the FBI. So I had one group of women, if you were, ahead of me. But the challenge was that they would sooner have stepped on us than helped us. You're talking about an environment where it was so difficult to get into that job. They had come in the mid to late 1970s, we're now in the early 80s, and it had been so difficult for them that they were all about protecting themselves and no one reached a handout to any of us. So that was very difficult. I had no women role models, but I was used to being around men. I was raised with brothers and a dad, and I'm comfortable around that. I always have been. But in the beginning, there were some significant challenges. One of these happened in the academy. And I will say that even the FBI, although they welcomed women in, they still weren't truly ready for us because all of the clothing that we wore for the fitness part of our training and the firearms part of our training was men's clothing. So there were no women's sizes for the clothing at that point, and the rooms, the dorm rooms we were in, were all configured for men's clothing and not women's clothing. So there were small things like that. But otherwise, I would say they were welcoming. But I had one instance during new agents training with one of my classmates who was a Vietnam War veteran and a pilot. And we were sitting around one evening after class having a couple of beers, and he just got really angry, and he said, you know, you don't belong here. You women don't belong here. We had to have higher scores. You got into the FBI with lower scores than anybody else, and that's not right. And I just looked at him, and as usual, when somebody challenges me, I sit straight up, and I looked at him, and I said, let me tell you something. I said, my scores were high enough to get me in as a white male. So your claims about people lowering scores to let me in are completely bogus, and we need to have an end to this conversation right now. And many years later, but 20 years later, I would say, we ran into one another at the FBI Academy, and I was serving overseas at that point in Africa and in Europe. And I said to him, you know, how are you doing? We exchanged some small talk, and I said, how's your daughter? Because I recalled that when we were going through the academy, he had a daughter who was a toddler. I don't recall her exact age, but under 5. And he just looked at me. He said, she's doing great. I said, what is she doing? And he said, she's a pilot for the Air Force.
Oh.
So it was a wonderful sort of closure to what had started 20 years earlier with his resentment of me being at the academy and then having a daughter. And she was a fighter pilot.
You know, this is so interesting to me because my dad is a fighter pilot. He used to be a fighter pilot. He's retired now. And he has told me how women in India are not allowed to be fighter pilots for some reason. And one of my friends actually in college sent out a message or an email to the National Defense Academy in India, which is where my dad got his training, asking to join. And they replied saying, we don't let women in. And growing up, I always just thought, oh, that is just the part and parcel of life. That is how it is. But now, as a 26-year-old myself, this I'm the same age you were when you joined the FBI. And I, right now, I'm getting this feeling that this is so wrong. It was very recently that we had our first woman fighter pilot in India fly her plane. Very recently, like 2 months ago, I think. And just looking back, that is so wrong. It took about 2 extra decades for this to happen in my country.
Yeah, a very long time. And I am really gratified that it's finally happening there. It's finally happening in Afghanistan and even in the Gulf. But it has taken so long, and even in the United States, quite frankly, although women have served our country during every war in one form or another, going back to our war for independence with the United Kingdom, it's still taken a long time for the recognition that women are capable of fighting in combat or piloting in combat. Because frankly, all men are not cut out for that. And so to just assume that women are the gentler sex and therefore can't do it is a mistake.
Well, we are living in a world where women only just got the pass to drive in Saudi Arabia. So it is very surprising, Ankita. I wasn't aware of what Ankita had just mentioned. So Ankita, when your friend tried to apply to become a fighter pilot, how long ago was this?
It was not to become a fighter pilot. She wanted to join the armed forces. So I think she was in school and she was just considering her options for college and she wanted to join the NDA. And this was, I think, in 2009. So she sent out this letter and this email to them, and the response was that we don't take girls in. Mm-hmm. And as far as I understand, they still don't take girls in.
Wow, my God.
And I think I also remember hearing, and I, you know, don't quote me on this, but I remember hearing that the reason why women can't be fighter pilots apparently is because of the gravitational force or how high up you fly, the speed at which you fly, women's bodies are not equipped. And I just, you know, I want to call bullshit at this point.
You need to call bullshit.
Growing up, growing up, I would just believe it. But right now, as as a woman myself, I want to call bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Lauren, you were studying to be a doctor in. Well, I don't want to put a timeline on anything because we don't want to expose your age over here because you did join the FBI. But you were studying to be a doctor in, let's just say, in the 70s for the sake of it. But how long did it take you to realize that that's not the path you wanted to go down?
Well, actually, it was a combination of my recognition and academic challenges. I had thought from the age of about 13 that I wanted to be a doctor, and in fact started as what we have in the United States, volunteers in hospitals. They're called candy stripers because of the uniform they wore. But once I started college, I started pre-med biology major, And the school that I went to, Muhlenberg College, is an excellent small liberal arts college, but it was so well known for its pre-med program that it was ridiculously competitive. And so they required us to take certain courses as freshmen and sophomores that essentially were courses to weed us out. They weren't courses intended to really move us forward toward getting to medical school. It was a way to figure out who could cut it and who couldn't. And frankly, I had some significant academic challenges at that point, and I call that period of time my first major failure in my life. And it was very difficult because this is what I thought I had wanted to do for, you know, at least probably 6 or 7 years at that point. And to realize that as hard as I was working, I was not able to get the kind of grades that I needed to move forward, it was horrible. It was very, very difficult, and it caused a lot of soul searching, you know, at the tender age of 19, and talking with my parents. My mom's was great. She said, you know, whatever you need to do, it's your decision. My dad initially was, you're not a quitter. Don't quit. And so I was dealing with this internal conflict, and I finally realized I cannot do this because I am not enjoying what I'm doing anymore. I'm not getting the grades that I want. And so I'm going to have to find another path in life. So that is what I did. And that path was changed and came to a fork in the road. And I took another fork at age 20, which brought me into an amazing life and an amazing career. I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I believe that things happen the way they're meant to happen.
Well, Lauren, I think, you're quite lucky that you had a supportive family at this point, because I don't know if you know this, but I'm a medical student. I'm in my final year of my studies right now. I'm studying in Prague, and it's an ongoing joke between Ankita and I. Like, neither of us know why I'm here. neither of us know what I'm still doing here. But the thing was, like, when I was, I'm not saying that I was forced into this career, but it was always drilled into my head that my parents wanted me to be a doctor. And it's only now that I realize that I could have actually said no, and I could have done something else, but I didn't have the courage to say that to my parents. And I went through something similar in the sense that I didn't get into medical school the first time. I only got in the second time. But even when I didn't get in the first time, my parents, there was no option to think that I couldn't do it. The only option was that I had to try again. And I think you're very lucky that you have parents who are so supportive and actually listen to your sentiments and listen to how you felt. Because at the time when I got rejected, I wasn't aware of anything else that I could do. And I think a lot of students in India or in our community probably echo the same sentiments that I have, that we don't really have this chance to actually stand up and say, you know what, this is not for me. And I think you're very lucky that you did that, because now it's led to this amazing life that you have right now.
Well, and I'm lucky that I had the family that I had, because frankly, that is still true in the United States, although probably not to the same extent that it is in India. And there are just some societal and cultural differences, but I still run into people here. I can recall talking to a 15-year-old girl some years ago who talked to me about my experience on the SWAT team. And she said, that's something I'd really love to do. And I told my mom, and my mom said, girls don't do that. And it was all that I could do to not have my face show my reaction, because I thought, are you serious? You know, it's just like 2011, and you're telling a 15-year-old girl in this day and age in New York City that she can't do things like that because girls don't do them. So there's no one part of the world that has the corner on how we push women into stereotypes and into certain positions and try to distract them from others. It's everywhere.
So Lauren, I actually studied in India, and both you and Meenal will find this interesting. In India, we have this whole system set up where kids are sent to coaching classes, and we're asked to prepare for either engineering or medicine, because these are considered to be the most respectable professions there. And in India, there is such a term as repeater. And if you go on an Indian street and you just say, I'm a repeater, everyone understands what you do, because you basically passed out of your grade 12 and you attempted or you appeared for a medical or engineering exam or to get into a college, and you didn't qualify. So you're repeating another year to study and prepare for the same entrance exam so that you can repeat and you can get through. And the children repeat for up to 3 years. And that's very common. So what Meenal said, it's just so, so common in India, where people just repeat and they just keep trying to get through this exam.
I mean, I don't think my parents would have made me repeat for 3 years. I think they would have understood that as a bit of a waste of my life. But they were still persistent that I tried again. And Ankita, I'm sure that if you were labeled a repeater, people would look down on you.
Oh, definitely. Yes. And I personally knew, because I had been to one of these coaching centers myself, not to get into an engineering or medical school, but just to get through my 10th and 12th standard exams. And I remember seeing some of these repeaters as old as 18, 19 years old, all of their friends, every year they make new friends and they move on to their own medical schools or whatever. But these kids are left behind and they just feel so depressed by the whole process of it. And It's just the reality of things there, you know. Sometimes people are forced to do things they don't want to do.
It seems very demoralizing, though, to be walking around and using a term about yourself and others that brands you as a failure rather than something else.
Yep.
They should call them triers.
Right.
That sounds better.
I like that better. It's like it's a totally different topic, but when you talk about people who've had cancer, often the term we used with them is survivors. And my friends and I
think
thrivers is a better way, not survivors.
So, Lauren, this is probably going to sound a little silly to you, but I'm a big fan of the show Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and they often portray the sexism and the homophobia that existed within the male-dominated public service sectors back in the 70s and 80s. And I've always, ever since I started watching that show, I've always wanted to know firsthand from someone like you if men in the FBI back then would just, you know, sit around smoking cigars in public spaces, drinking whiskey, passing derogatory comments. Was that a thing?
Well, when I first came in, they were definitely still smoking in offices, and the supervisor would often have a bottle of scotch in a desk drawer. That's true. but no, I have to say that from the beginning of my career, with very few exceptions, and there were some, and they were spectacular when they happened, but I was overall treated very well. I probably had more challenges with some of my age peers, rather than the older guys, because as the older guys sat and worked with me day in and day out, they looked at me and they thought, oh, she's close to my daughter's age. And so by turning that around, and for many men, that's what it happens, is like, she could be my daughter. Would I want my daughter being spoken to that way? Or would I like to have this conversation in front of my daughter? It really kind of changed the dynamic. And this is looking back. This is not a conversation we had at that time. But it is looking back in hindsight. And they actually treated me very well because it became a question of competence. And for me, it was all about how can I be the best at this job? How can I be the best FBI agent? How can I be the best person? And most guys, once they realized that that's what you were about and that you were fully capable of doing what needed to be done, then they were accepting. I mean, my reason for trying out for the SWAT team was not to be one of the first women on a SWAT team. It was because I still lacked some confidence in my tactical skills. And I thought, well, gee, if I try out and I get on the SWAT team, number one, it gives me more tactical experience. Number two, it gets me around the guys in a different environment and they can see how I function and that they can trust me to back them up on the street. And so that was my driver, again, trying to be better, not to achieve some sort of mantle of first woman this or first woman that. That never drove me.
Mm. And Lauren, can you tell us about the time when trusting your gut saved your life when there were three men pointing guns at you?
Yeah, that was quite an experience. It was actually my first major arrest as an agent. And I had been out of the FBI Academy about 6 months. And I was assigned to a particular role to arrest one of the top three people. It was an organized crime and drug conspiracy investigation. And I was paired with an older agent who he was one of the few who would make what I would call smart-ass comments while we were sitting in the car together waiting for the word for this all to happen. He said, okay, Ms. SWAT, you can go kick in the door then if you're so cool. And I just looked at him and I thought to myself, really? So I just said, we're not going to have to kick in the door. I'm going to get her to open it. And he just kind of, he he had a few other choice words and just kind of flicked his hand off at me. And so we're sitting there for a while because we had to do something that we referred to as a simultaneous takedown, which meant that we were doing a series of multiple arrests. I think it was, I don't remember the exact number, but I'm going to say in the neighborhood of 10 or 12, all around a wide geographical area, and we all had to do it at the same time. So while we're waiting, cars were pulling up to the apartment building where this woman lived, and people would stop. A person would get out of the car, go into the apartment building, come back out, they'd get away and leave. So based on even my limited experience at that time, that kind of behavior would be consistent with somebody who was going in to purchase cocaine and leaving, and that's what she was doing, was selling cocaine. So this went on for a while, and I pointed it out to the agent, and he, again, was dismissive of me. So when the message finally comes that we're all to go, we had other people in other cars around us. We had some Milwaukee Police Department officers. We had some Milwaukee Sheriff's County Sheriff's officers. And I said to him, she's going to open the door. And he's just looking at me. So I went right up to the door. I knocked on the door, and she came to the door. Her name was Gail. And she goes, yes. And I said, hey, Gail, my name's Debbie. I live upstairs, and I got your mail by mistake today, so I just wanted to bring it down to you. And what did she do? She opened the door. So there was no need to kick the door in. So we pushed in, and in we go, and lo and behold, there's three guys with guns pointed at us. And we were in a very, very small space, probably no more than, not even 2 meters apart. And everybody's pointing guns at everyone. And finally, the three who were in there to buy cocaine realized that they were going to be outgunned and outmaneuvered. And so no shots were exchanged. Everyone was arrested. So in any event, then the same guy says to me, okay, take Gail out and process her. And I said, I'm not going out there alone. Because for me to take her out alone so that everyone understands, she was in handcuffs. She was handcuffed behind her back. I would have been required to have one hand on her handcuffs and the other hand on her arm, which meant that my own weapon, my gun, had to be holstered. And I will also point out that those being the days they were, now you see how everybody wears tactical clothing. I was in a suit jacket, a skirt, and heels. That's how I was dressed. And so he said, go out and take her. And I said, no. I said, because I told you, I saw people going in and out of the apartment building, and even though we couldn't be sure it was her apartment, we got these three guys in here who were clearly in here to purchase cocaine. They didn't walk. I said, I'm sure there's cars out there, and I'm not going out. And so he starts getting into an argument with me, and I very quietly tried to take him aside and said, look, I don't want to have an argument. It's not appropriate in here, but I'm not walking outside with her alone. And I said, call somebody, call Milwaukee PD, call the sheriff's office, get somebody else out there before I walk out the door. Finally, he agreed, although without, of course, with additional derisive comments. And so when it finally happened, we waited a bit. He got a phone call and he said, okay, you can take her out now. And when we walked out, there was multiple police cars, and it turned out that it literally took a small van to cart everybody away. They arrested somewhere in the vicinity of 12 people out there, all of whom had weapons in three or four different cars. They had guns, they had knives. So my instinct about not going out there alone and my paying attention to what was going on and my willingness to stand up to somebody that I regarded as a superior and certainly a more experienced agent, unquestionably, in my opinion, saved my life and saved Gail's life, because we would have walked out into that. They would have seen her in cuffs and me, and that would have been it. It would have been, you know, gunfire at the OK Corral or something else. And so for me, that was a huge lesson early on about trusting my instincts, regardless of what other people were saying around me, and pushing forward with that.
Can we just remind everyone who's listening that you did this arrest while you were in high heels and in a skirt suit?
I'm wearing body armor. That was the other piece. I had a bulletproof vest that I had on underneath my blouse. And the other funny thing about that is that the guys in the office made fun of me. They said, well, what are you putting that on for? I said, because I was given it, and it's protection against gunshots. And they said, oh, she's a coked out woman. Don't worry about her. There it was. a big lesson.
And you were just 6 months into the program at the time. So, Lauren, you know, that was so long ago. But currently, right now, you're developing a program to grow the next generation of law enforcement in countries emerging from conflict. And because, you know, we cater to a South Asian community mostly, you know, that is the kind of countries that our South Asian community also belongs to. So could you briefly tell us about the program that you're developing and why it's important to target these areas?
Well, it's something that I developed. I would say that I thought about this while I was still working for the FBI, and I actually talked to some young people about it, and I bounced it off people who came from Africa and other parts of the world, because what I saw in the years that I was working overseas, and I did work in Europe, I worked in the Middle East, and I worked in Africa. So I was in countries that were either in or coming out of conflict. And what I saw over and over, which is not dissimilar to what it is in South Asia, is there's a tremendous amount of corruption, systemic corruption that's been there forever. And I saw that in the training that we provided and shared with our counterparts in these countries, they were eager for the training, for example, how to process a crime scene, how to process a post-blast or a post-terrorism incident. And along with that, we always included a component of respect for rule of law, respect for human rights, and anti-corruption training. And I realized after all that time that if I was lucky, I was going to get through to one or maybe two people in each of those classes that we were providing training. And I thought there's got to be a better way. And one of the other events that happened to me that was a further impetus is when I was running the Joint Terrorism Task Force here in New York City, I often met with foreign officials at the request of the U.S. State Department. And one particular event, I was meeting with judges and lawyers from the Middle East and North Africa. And interestingly, there were two women judges from Yemen, which at that time was not embroiled in the conflict that it is today. And they asked me, with a lot of strength, they said, why do you deal with our governments and these officials in our countries when you know they're corrupt and you know they have no respect for the rule of law and you know they disrespect our rights? And I'm watching and I see the State Department person just start curling into a tiny ball thinking, oh no, oh no. And I said, you know what? That's a great question. And I'm glad you asked it. Because from my perspective, I completely agree with you. You're absolutely right. I've seen it. It appalls me. But I thought I would much rather take the route of having a conversation, having a dialogue, showing that the job can be done while adhering to the rule of law and while respecting people's rights. And I would consciously say in some situations, if you can get this for me legally, fine. If you can't, I don't want it. I made the personal decision that if it couldn't be obtained in a way that was legal and not violating somebody's rights, I'd rather not have the information. And so that is the path that I chose. And I said, to have no conversation and no dialogue doesn't do anything. But to have a conversation, a dialogue, a recognition, an attempt to get through, even if it's only to one or two people in a particular organization, is far better than how it was before. And I thought there's got to be a better way. And I was doing some work when I came back to the United States with young people in high school and junior high school. And I saw that in working with them at that age, the biases were not inherent in a way that they were in adults. And we had this program called Law Enforcement Exploring that was part of a broader organization that is only in the United States. And I saw that teaching them how to be leaders, working on building character, teaching them an understanding and sensitivity towards others, whether they look like them or not, and then using that as a means of trying to develop that next generation of law enforcement would probably be the only way to affect real change. I saw kids, New York City, as I'm sure you know, and many of your listeners may know, is extremely diverse, and more than 50% of the population are immigrants from other parts of the world. So we had a Muslim brother and sister from Morocco. We had a Chinese kid. We had kids from Puerto Rico. So we had a great diversity. And they all learned to grow together, to work together as teams, and not just on learning procedures like how to interview somebody, you know, how to clear a room, things like that. But public speaking and community service was a huge component of that. And every single weekend during the school year, we were out doing things in the community. And I saw how effective that was. And I'm still in touch with a lot of these young people, some of whom are now practicing lawyers, some are police officers, some are applying for federal employment in the United States. And I realized that it's that kind of a model that needs to be brought elsewhere. And honestly, although I have the thought and I would work with people, it cannot come from the middle-aged white woman from the United States. It has to be something that's embraced within the community. And so my thought process, because I have not been able to find any organization anywhere thus far that is doing anything like this. And so for me to be able to partner with people within a community, and it needs to start in a community or a village somewhere, to start developing it there, have it be embraced, and then have that hopefully turn into the pipeline to people going into all rule of law institutions, not just law enforcement, but prosecutors, judges, really anybody moving up. Because if you work at that age and people see the value of what diversity of thought and diversity of appearance brings to any equation, they realize that that's the best way to approach anything in the world.
And Lauren, to say that you've traveled a lot would be an understatement. You've served in over 24 countries, and I'm assuming you've traveled even more extensively while not being posted somewhere. So they usually say that a big unifying factor for humans is travel, especially when one finds oneself in an environment where no one else speaks the same language. So do you relate to that sentiment, or was it quite a harrowing experience being in a place where nobody understands you, and especially when you're trying to do such amazing work and work that needs a lot of detail and, you know, in intricacy as well?
I would say that the first thing that I did, although I had not, and this will be surprising to both of you, apart from a quick trip to Canada, I had never left the United States until I was 37 years old. So it was a very big change in frame of reference. But for me, what I realized early on, from the time I was a kid, actually, is that it was important to understand somebody else's perspective. So when I started traveling overseas, I would try and learn bits of a language from wherever I was traveling to. I studied German all through college and high school and junior high. So I had 7 years of German. But then when I was selected for the FBI position to run the office in Paris, which encompassed 24 countries, 22 of them in Africa, I said right away, I've got to learn French. And literally before they can even get me into a class, I reached out to our language services people and asked for tapes that I could listen to in my car. So I knew that making an effort to learn the language was going to both make me more effective and make my experience far more enjoyable. So that helped. But I think probably one of the other things that's made for the most effective FBI personnel who are deployed overseas is a desire to keep learning. I will learn until and be curious until the day I die. And I am deeply interested in knowing about other people and how they live and what's important to them. And the FBI personnel that I saw who were the most successful in that overseas environment were people who felt that way, who were genuinely interested and who were able to set aside the way of doing business in the U.S., which is, okay, we're in here to do business, we got to sit down, we got to talk business, then we're leaving and going back to our offices, and really change that mindset and recognize that sitting down and getting to know the person sitting across from you or next to you as a human being was really important before you got to the work. And for a super type A personality like me, that was an adjustment, but it was a conscious one. And to me, that was the only way to be successful. Was everything all happy and delightful with no problems? No, absolutely not. And there were situations that I was in which I felt very threatened. In one situation, I won't name the country, but I had some people, agents visiting from Washington, and I said, well, you know, I've paid for bodyguards. They're going to accompany us up into the north of the country. It was an area where there's a lot of conflict, and there's currently Islamic State and Al-Qaeda still mulling about. This is in Africa. And they said, okay, good. Right. We've got these bodyguards. And I looked at them and I laughed and I said, yeah, well, for another $10, they'll sell us. So don't get too comfortable about them being our protectors. So you kind of have to have that approach. But to me, being open and loving to learn and experiencing things person to person is what made the difference for me. And that helped in many situations, not all, but in many situations.
And, you know, while you were posted in all of these areas throughout Africa, Europe, even the Middle East, you've led the terrorism and criminal investigations for FBI. So I just want to get this clear. Later, Lauren, you've also led the International Terrorism Program for the FBI's New York Joint Terrorism Task Force. So I just want to discuss terrorism with you a little bit, because unfortunately, this is not as novel an idea as it used to be back in 2001 when the entire world witnessed the Twin Towers coming down. But I'm speaking from the public's point of view. We like to believe that the attacks we get to hear of are the only ones that have been successful, that there are a lot more being diffused by agencies like the ones that you've been involved with, and that we only hear of the ones that have been successful. Is that true?
I think that's true to a great extent. It's increasingly difficult to keep anything a secret or behind the scenes with the world we live in terms of immediate communication. But the world that I lived in for nearly 30 years of my life was one in which we were expected to be perfect, what we call a zero-sum game. And the belief that we can ever make a mistake. You can look at sporting activities as one comparison. You can look at the business sector for another, where people are allowed to make mistakes and it's okay. You move onward from there. But is zero tolerance for mistakes when it comes to the world that I inhabited and for all of those around the world who are deeply committed to protecting the people and the country that they live in. And there are many, many things that go on that no one ever hears about. And so it would be difficult to put a number on that at this point in time, but if I could do a rough comparison over the length of time that I worked for the FBI, I would say there was far more that happened that we prevented than actually happened, far more. Because
that really helps us sleep at night.
Well, you know, it should, you know, and it depends where you are. People often ask, I have confidence in the agencies that do that work. And in the United States, I have enormous confidence in the agencies. There are blips in the radar. Mm. There are differences of opinion. There are differences in approach and technique from time to time. But I have enormous confidence. There's a much greater degree of transparency and openness among agencies, a willingness to talk with one another and share ideas. And that is true in other countries, but unfortunately not in a lot of other countries. And I think that would help greatly. If we take, for example, what's the attacks that happened in France and Belgium in the last couple of years, I found the French to be exceptional partners. I loved working with them. I'm sure as they viewed me as a challenge sometime, I viewed them as a challenge sometimes, but they were superb at what they did, and they were willing to share very, very openly with us. And when I say us, I mean the USS, not just the FBI. And Belgium independently would share to a point, and Belgium wasn't my territory at the time. But they wouldn't talk to each other. We had a terrorism case back through 2002. It started in late 2001. There was a plot to, and this is an illustration, it was a plot to attack the U.S. Embassy in Paris, and it was thwarted.
Right.
And it was a great collaborative effort. But as we move forward with all these different countries trying to do an investigation together, they would share bilaterally with us, but they would not share in a multilateral sense. And efforts to get representatives from multiple West European countries to sit down together and talk about this were really challenging, because they'd say, well, we trust you, we'll tell you, but we're not telling them. And although I was not privy, because I was out of the FBI at that point in time, to everything that was going on behind the scenes in France and Belgium based on my experience in the region for 5 years. And after that, when I was running the task force in New York, those same challenges persisted. And I believe that they regrettably have added to an environment that has allowed for more attacks to occur. That said, they have done a remarkable job in thwarting a lot of attacks, and the French have, but you know, they too were blasted in the media about why didn't they stop this? Why was this individual out? Because the Charlie Hebdo guys who committed that attack had their as their spiritual advisor, a man named Jamal Bagal, who was one of the primary people involved in the attack, the plot to attack the U.S. Embassy in Paris, but who had served his time and was out of prison. So it's not a simple situation, but I have great confidence about all the agencies in the United States and in certain other countries around the world, too. And I found most of my counterparts in most of the countries I dealt with to be great partners.
And Lauren, there's a very strong racial component to even the word terrorism, especially since 2001. And you were in service at the time of the 9/11 attacks, and you have witnessed this wave of change in terms of people's perception of terrorism since then. Now, the world is predisposed to relate all terrorism with one religion and one, you know, sector of people. But what does your experience tell you about this? Do you feel like we're slowly moving on in our thinking, and we're slowly becoming more open-minded in this sort of area of thinking, especially when it comes to terrorism and pointing fingers at people?
I know that there are many reasons why some choose violence as a means of advocating for a belief or imposing a certain belief or imposing political change. I understand that, and those reasons are varied. And regrettably, at the base of some of this, there is religion, and it is not just Islam. You have only to look at Ireland to understand what was going on with the Catholics and the Protestants and many other nations. So there is a religion aspect to it, but there are many other things that feed into that. And so, for example, if you were to look at or talk to somebody who was radicalized and talk to them about what their motivation was, what you might hear from somebody in Africa is going to be very different than what you might hear from somebody in the Gulf or somebody in Europe. And it is, again, driven by the experiences they've had up to that point in time. But from my way of thinking, whether it's terrorism or whether you're looking at conflict, you can look at all conflict around the world. You can look at terrorism, regardless of who's perpetrating it, whether it's coming from the Tamil Tigers, whether it's coming from Chechen separatists. At the root of all of this is a group of people who think the same and who don't want any diversity. That diversity can be gender-based. Mm. That diversity can be religious. It can be racial. It can be based on skin color. It can be anything. But it is desire for people who want only those who think and look like them around them, and then making decisions on the basis of that. And to me, along with other factors, which can't be ignored, in terms of inequities and economic disparities, that certainly plays into it. But at its root, to me, it's a lack of diversity. And I think it's a huge mistake for any people. And believe me, I know there's many in my own country who think that terrorism is strictly related to religion and it is related to Islam. That's absurd. It's absolutely absurd. And in fact, if you look at the statistics in the United States going back 40 years, what you will find is that the overwhelming majority, and I haven't recently looked at the numbers, but the overwhelming majority of what was classified as a terrorist incident, be it domestic or international, was perpetrated by white people in the United States who were not Muslim.
I mean, even recently with the school shootings, you would say.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a big discussion over whether that constitutes terrorism. And, you know, I would argue from my perspective that it does. And whether it's school shootings, whether it's other incidences, in the United States, it's far more often been at the hands of white men. And I have nothing against white men. I love them. But, you know, the reality is that what we are fed oftentimes in our media and by political officials in many countries is they feed on and they're able to raise money and get accomplished what they want or hope to by play into fear factors of people. And we are so connected right now in the world, and information flies so quickly around the world, that nobody's taking the time to really step back and think about what they're hearing and whether or not it makes sense. They're just reacting to it. You know, and that's whether you think Facebook is a place to get news, and God, I hope people are getting news someplace other than Facebook. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, truly, we just react. We don't stop and think anymore. And that goes for terrorism, and it goes for people playing to fears and saying, well, all terrorists are Muslim. That's patently absurd.
Well, I don't think we have time to react, Lauren, because there's so much information being thrown at us every 5 minutes on social media. There's no chance to even think about any headline we see or any image we see, because then we just don't have time, because then the next one will come up.
It's true. And you know, that actually impacts the way governments function. And this is, to me, a frightening thing, because in the past, when information wasn't flying so quickly, governments, organizations could do what they needed to do. And if they hit a bump in the road or something happened, they had the time to think through it and consider all the consequences, both intended and unintended. And in the world we live in now, that's almost impossible. And that is really an unfair position to put all of our leaders in by expecting and demanding that they respond instantly to things without giving thought to it and without being able to consider all the ramifications. And that I see as a serious downside to the way information flows in social media. There's clearly an upside, but that's a downside, is it's putting an inordinate amount of pressure on people who have to make serious decisions that impact other people's lives, and to force them to do it in a glass bubble and in, you know, 10 seconds on your time frame is unreasonable and it's unsafe.
So, Lauren, women's safety is another thing that we wish to discuss with you, because especially since both Meenal and I are Indians, I want to give you a few statistics from India, which is that nearly 4 out of 5 women, which is about 79% of the women in India, have experienced some form of harassment or violence in public. And that is according to the latest survey by ActionAid UK. And it's only after the Delhi gang rape of 2012, which made international news, that it's become more widely known that even babies and really aged women are not very safe in many parts of our country. So how do you think a country like ours can move forward from a position like that in terms of women's safety?
Well, I don't envy those who live in India for that part. There are many, many wonderful things about India.
Yeah.
But it's a tough situation, and it's not something that's going to change overnight. You know, I look at it in the way of looking at the progression of women, just as we were speaking about earlier in our conversation about, you spoke about women going into the military and what the perspective was in India.
Yeah.
And it's going to take time of working together as a community, again, bringing people together, as a number of organizations are doing. Safe City is one. The Gender Lab that Ayushi Banerjee and some others run in India is another great one, which is, again, in the same vein as me talking about wanting to work with young people to develop that next generation of law enforcement. It's working with young people to start with, to have them see that it's not okay to behave in a certain way. It's not okay to say things or write things about a girl or about a woman. It's not okay to touch. And I think that has to start at a very young age. And once you start that, then you're going to start changing those perceptions. But I think continuing to have the open conversation, and I've been following what's gone on since the attack on Jyoti Singh and her friend back in 2012. And there's been much more of a dialogue publicly in India in a way that there has not been before. And I think the more that societies are willing to talk openly and honestly, to share feelings and discuss why it's not okay, is the only way forward. And I think, you know, going out and working in the corporate world, but frankly, you know, this goes for any place, any country in the world, any organization in the world. The leaders set the tone. People watch what the leaders do and say, and they watch how they behave. And whether that is using the power of your ability to vote in India, in who you elect to public office, and what your expectations are of people who rise as leaders, and that's your official leadership. But then you've got the unofficial leaders. We all know that with any group, within a society, with any community, with any village, there are unofficial leaders as well, and we have to encourage those people to step forward and make their voices known and become advocates. Because the more that we have men and boys as our advocates, as women, the better it's going to be. And frankly, it goes beyond women. I would expand that to the LGBTQ community as well. They are often victimized at horrific rates, tremendous amount of violence, and that's in many places around the world. And again, it's an issue. It's just an issue everywhere. I was in Argentina last fall and having dialogue with the community there because it's an issue for women and girls there. But there were also people from the LGBTQ and disability community.
Right.
And so to me, I have seen from personal experience in many parts of the world that the greater effort that is made to sit down, sit in a circle, sit and talk to each other about why, not just you shouldn't do that, but why it makes you feel that way and what that does to your daily activity, like your safety going back and forth to school or to work, or how it makes you feel in your family, or what kind of people you're raising. It is so much broader than just women should have this because. It's going to create a much better community. And you have so many phenomenal things and people and places in India that I think to keep the forward momentum that's underway right now, and it is, it's going to take time, but it's already better than it was because people are talking about it openly. And you have men coming together, not just in cities, but in more rural areas of India. And they're sitting and having conversations about it. And that's what's important.
So I just asked you the how, like, how do you think a country can move forward? But I also want to ask you the where of this problem, as in what should be our short-term goals? Where are we going from here?
Are you speaking worldwide or are you
speaking? No, I'm speaking in terms of India specifically.
I think the short-term goals can be, if you go back to, you mentioned education. I don't know what the educational curriculum looks like in a typical Indian public school. And I'm talking about primary and secondary education. But I think that if things start happening there, they have to start there in terms of your where and in communities. Now, cities, it's really tough because they're huge and your population is enormous. But again, I think you have to start at your smallest constituency, whether that's a neighborhood, whether that's a village, whether that is your workplace or your school. You can make those changes. I was also recently in Mexico and went to a kindergarten and primary school for kids who had nothing. They were from the most poverty-ridden neighborhoods there. And I was in a similar place in Kathmandu, Nepal last summer. But what I saw is the choice of what the curriculum looked like for those kids starting at kindergarten age and moving upward was respect for each other, sensitivity to the fact that other people might look differently or feel differently or speak differently, but that's okay. And basically a focus on overarching common goals about how we treat people was in evidence. And you couldn't have two more diverse places than Mexico and Nepal. And you could put India in there. And I think it is, again, starting at home. It's starting in the schools and taking that group that you're a part of, because you're such a huge country as we are, and you're much larger than the United States, that you must start somewhere. And I think that the two of you, by talking to people, all different topics, but by talking to people and sharing it with the broader community at large, the diaspora around the world, and then some of the organizations like Safe City, Safety is another one that Shruti Kapoor works with, and Ayushi Banerjee's Gender Lab. There are so many out there who are doing phenomenal work, and they're crossing sectors. They're just not staying in schools. They're going into corporations. They're dealing with government officials. And when I have seen change happen in my own country, it has been a result of that willingness to have those conversations and to listen. And I think it is happening in India. It needs to happen more, but I think that what is underway now, and I say it from a distance and from what I've read and heard, so I give it with that caveat. But I think there are tremendous strides being made, and each of us has a responsibility. Each person has a responsibility. to do their own bit for that. It's not okay to say the government should do it or the school should do it.
Yeah.
We are each responsible as human beings who live on this earth to make the change in our own way, in our own lives, every day, in the way that we treat people.
So it all starts from a very small level, and eventually it all adds up, doesn't it? And it goes from treating each other with respect and eventually taking that to our communities and making, you know, bringing that overall effect that we all treat each other with respect, and hopefully that will bring a change as well.
And that's what's really important, because you can pass laws, and this is something that I've recently been doing some talking and writing about. You can pass all the laws you want, but people don't have to pay attention to them. And again, it goes to who has the power in any given location, whether it is something as large as who has the power in running India, or whether it is something as, you know, who is in charge in rural parts of the area. The power is still sitting with a small group of people. And until that piece of it also changes, and there's greater diversity, who has the power, you can pass all the laws in the world. They're not going to get enforced. And that's why individual responsibility and moving forward becomes so incredibly important. There's mandatory reporting laws in Argentina, for example, for violence against women. But and rape and sexual assault and everything else. But when you get into some portions of the country, and this is, I'm not by no means trying to tar Argentina in a negative way. I'm just speaking about a reality.
Yep.
That when you get outside of a major city, the likelihood of the responsiveness of officials to something that happens, that response level diminishes. And then they might take that initial report, but whether they take it any further, that diminishes. So laws by themselves aren't going to do it. They are a tool. But without these other tools, they are not going to make the change.
And Lauren, you're on the advisory boards for Beyond Diversity Foundation in India, and you work closely with the Red Dot Foundation and the Safe City app. We recently interviewed the founder of Safe City, Elsa De Silva, on our podcast, and we're sure that you have quite an in-depth understanding of the condition of women's safety in India. So we wanted to know how you specifically contribute to all these Indian organizations.
Okay, well, I have two different roles, although there are some similarities. So with Beyond Diversity, I'm on the advisory board, and it was thanks to having met Sarika last year in Kathmandu, Nepal. She is working towards greater diversity and inclusion when it comes to a business community. So her focus is strictly in that area. She's also very focused on getting more women on boards. And they have an event coming up on April 27th in Delhi called I Inspire. That will also focus on that. She's done a tremendous job, again, with not just speaking with women, but reaching out to corporations, engaging men, and talking with them about the importance, not just of presence of women, but mentoring women, and again, recognizing what each brings to the equation. So they are working very much in the corporate sector, whereas Safe City is broader in a sense that it's dealing with the community, and that community is throughout India. And now with the foundation expanding, is in multiple countries around the world, including in Africa, South America, the Caribbean, and the United States. And my work with Elsa is a little bit different. Well, I serve as an advisor to Sarika, and we're working together and collaborating there. I am actually helping Elsa build her global organization. And what I bring to that is the perspective of what government's view is going to be and why government needs to be a part of the solution and not cut out of the problem. There are other organizations that do similar work to the Red Dot Foundation and Safe City, but they don't talk with law enforcement, and they gather data, but they don't share it. And that's what makes the work differently. So with Elsa, we have been working together on a strategic plan on how to best expand Safe City so that the success that it's realized thus far in India can be replicated, but appropriately to the country and the culture in which it moves to next. Similarly, we've also talked about how to engage government. Elsa's done a remarkably successful job in several cities in India, in Delhi, Mumbai, Goa, and engaging the governmental officials, because she knows India. where I'm able to help her is because I've worked in so many countries around the world and dealt with my counterparts in government, not just law enforcement, but in the diplomatic sector and various ministries. We are working together on how best to engage and negotiate that part of the equation. So it's, I would say it's much more of a hands-on role with ELSA in helping grow the organization to a global entity, whereas with the work that I'm doing with Sarayka, she also is looking to go globally, and she will. But it's a different role. One's more of an advisor, which one is much more hands-on in terms of moving the organization and its great work forward on a day-to-day basis.
And Lauren, do you believe that more women in law enforcement like you, in countries like ours, would be a big step towards eliminating sexual harassment and women's safety issues?
Unquestionably. There are a number of countries in the world that have set up women-only police stations. And while on the face of it, that's a good step forward, it's not the only step, because just as I was speaking about earlier with the enforcement of laws, you can have somebody go into a women-only police station and report something that's happened, and that's fabulous. It's going to encourage more people to be willing to come forward and talk about victimization of any crime. It doesn't have to be sexual harassment, sexual violence. It could be theft. It could be anything. And that's tremendous. But where it's not working in many places is that it stops at that point because there's not the political will to then move those allegations or those criminal activity towards prosecution and then moving into the judicial system for the country, whatever that looks like. So again, it's fixing one piece, but it's not fixing the whole. I know for a fact from what I have seen in the United States and around the world that when more women are in rule of law institutions, there is less violence. There are much fewer allegations of abuse of rights. And there is a much better relationship with the government institutions. The same could be true of women in conflict. When women are at the table, and there's a lot of UN information on this, it makes a difference. When women have been a part of peacekeeping operations, again, statistically, the UN can demonstrate more people come forward. They're more honest about what has happened. But that includes for victims like men. We often forget when we look at conflict and we look at sexual violence, we forget that men and boys are also victimized in a horrific way. But it's rarely reported because of cultural, religious, and societal constraints, but it happens. And I have talked with both men and women who have been victims of sexual violence and conflict. And it is not pretty. And it is really, really tough. But I also know, again, from my own experience, that people in general are more willing to talk to a woman when something bad has happened to them. It's just a reality. It was true when I was a boss in the FBI. I was amazed when I first became part of management. The things that guys would tell me privately in my office, it blew my mind. It really did. And then I realized, well, first they have to have a trust. But there is just something about a lot of women, not all women, but there's just something that there is an inherent trust that somebody is willing to give to a woman that they're not as willing to give to a man if they don't know them. And I know it makes a difference. And when you look at statistically, it's out there too. When you look at countries in your region of the world, and you look at the low percentages of women in law enforcement, to pick a neighbor that you don't always get along with, but in Pakistan, there's well over 400,000 law enforcement officers. Less than 1% are women. When you look at the level of safety for women in the country, it's really tough. Somalia is another place like that, so is the Congo. But when you look at countries like Sweden and Norway and certain other countries in Western Europe where you have, frankly, the highest percentages of women in law enforcement, where they go upwards of 25 to between 25 and 33%, there's a remarkable difference in what's going on in terms of street crime. It makes a difference, and it's demonstrable. That said, it's tough to get women into law enforcement and to keep them there. The United States has stayed for more than 25 years at approximately 12% of women in law enforcement across all agencies. So it makes a difference. But we've got to do more to get more women in there.
And Lauren, since you've had such a big experience in the FBI, do you have any advice for all women listening to this episode regarding safety in general? And you already know that, especially in India, this is something that we do need more of. I think women should be taught more of self-defense, especially in school, and women should be more aware of how they can actually protect themselves. So do you have any advice for anybody who's listening in India or anywhere in the world, really?
I do. You know, the single biggest thing you can do, anyone can do, to ensure that they are safe and stay safe is to pay attention to what is going on around you. It is the single biggest thing. If we think about how all of us are in the connected world, I'm not talking about parts of the world where everyone's not running around with a smartphone. Being aware of everything in your surroundings is critical. I started playing a game with myself before I was in the FBI, when I was living in New York City as a young 20-something right out of college. And I would get on the subway, and I would look around at everybody on the subway, and I would pick a couple of people and pay attention to what they were wearing. Like, did they have a baseball hat on? What did their shoes look like? Was there something unique about them? And then I would get off the train and, walking back, think about what I could remember about that person. But it was just a small memory game, but you know, you pay attention to what's around you, you're going to know and you're going to feel when something's not right. And I think that's the single biggest thing we can do, is an awareness. You wouldn't be amazed, actually, how many people walk, take public transportation, or drive the same route every day, but if you asked them what road they were on, what the name of it was, or asked them to tell you about a business on the way, they can't do it because they're not paying attention.
This is really interesting to me, because I had this conversation with my husband the other day, and I was asking him, you know, we watch a lot of crime fiction dramas, we read crime fiction. I was asking him, would you ever be able to describe someone you randomly saw when a crime was happening? And he thought for a minute and he said, I don't think so. And neither would I, because we're all a bit distracted whenever we're walking. We're either listening to something, music, or, you know, podcasts or whatever. We're not really paying attention. So this is a very interesting game that you just described.
It's fascinating, because the other thing that I learned when I was going through FBI agent training is they always said to us, okay, yes, you're supposed to take action. You're the one with the badge and the gun. But there may be a situation when you can't. And in that situation, you need to be the best witness that you can be, which means paying attention to your environment. So what I was intuitively doing as a girl and a young woman was something that was then reinforced in that training. And I think that that's the single biggest thing you can do, because if you're paying attention to what's going on, you'll know when something's not right. You'll feel it before your brain recognizes it. Your gut's going to feel it first. You know, there are other small things. You know, if you're concerned about your safety, don't be a creature of routine. The same thing that I just talked about is people take the same route every day, regardless of how they take it. Change it up. You'll start noticing things differently, and then you are less likely potentially to be victimized, because the people who are looking to do you harm, whatever that harm is, whether it's stealing your purse, your cell phone, physically assaulting you, they're watching you in most instances before they even approach you. So make it harder. Take a different route. Go a different way. Don't do it the same time of day. These are all things that, as a professional, when we were conducting surveillance of people, you look for these things. The people that made it toughest for us to follow were the ones who didn't do the same thing the same way the same day.
Right.
And that's the single biggest thing that can make you safe, is that awareness, and know what's going on, and don't do the same thing all the time. I mean, you're not going to be able to change your whole life. That's not realistic. But if you take it one day at a time and say, okay, today I'm going that way, or I'm going to take this bus, or I'm going to ride a bike, I'm going to do something differently. But don't make it easy for people. And you'd be amazed how many people who are victims have made it easy for the other person. And I'm not blaming the victim at all.
But this is an unconscious thing that you're doing on a daily basis.
Right. You know, we have to take responsibilities to some extent for ourselves. And you do the best you can to keep yourself safe And sometimes that's not enough and something happens, and that's okay. It's not your fault. You just need to be the best observer at that point in time. So when it comes to telling somebody what happens, you're able to observe, and you're not going to be able to remember everything. Focus on something that's unique. Something. Everybody's got something about them that's unique, whether it's an item they're wearing, whether it's how they smell, whether it's the way they talk. But there will be something. And smell, this is another thing I say to people. You look with your eyes, but you also need to hear and smell. If you ask me, for example, about what was my time like in Africa, what I'm going to come to you first with is what Africa smelled like to me. That's what comes back to me first.
That's interesting.
So that's another sense that we underuse, and it is something that can be used to protect you. Use all of your senses, not just one.
And Lauren, we've come a really long way from that day when you were 11 years old and you were touring the FBI headquarters and your tour guide told you that you can't be a girl joining the FBI. But, you know, starting with the Women's March in 2016, all the way to the Me Too campaign last year, you know, there's been this wide awakening in the feminist movement. And it must be really interesting for you to also notice these changes. But along, you know, on the flip side, there's also been quite a lot of backlash against the movement. So do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah. I think sometimes that when the pendulum swings, it swings too far in one direction. And as the woman who writes for the Washington Post in the United States said, we shouldn't, and she was talking in not in a literal sense, in a theoretical sense, we shouldn't be imposing capital punishment for everything that happens. And I completely agree with her, because the reason there's a backlash is because some people have the view, certainly the behavior is wrong. I completely agree with that. But somebody who makes an inadvertent, stupid comment in a workplace versus somebody who is raping a woman, that's a very wide spectrum. And the guy who's raping somebody shouldn't be treated the same way the guy who made the stupid comment in the workplace. And that's where I think you're finding the backlash, is you have some people who are being very, very militant and who are having zero tolerance for certain things. And they're demanding it be a certain way. And that's not real, because all men are not out to do evil things to women. That's absolutely absurd. Yes, there is groupthink, and yes, there are people who do things wrong everywhere in the world, but to say some of the ridiculous things that I have read in the media and heard people say, well, now women shouldn't be going to business dinners with male colleagues, I just fail to understand that.
Yeah.
You're adults, you know how to behave in any situation, and any man or any woman by that point in life knows how to behave with somebody. And when I've had people say inappropriate things to me, my choice is to try and diffuse it with humor. So, you know, I'll throw it back in a humorous way rather than getting angry. So there's a lot of ways to deal with it, but I am very wary and concerned when the pendulum swings too far to one side. And again, it's about action. You know, there's been a lot of people who've taken shots at the Hollywood community in the United States before. They were talking about the Academy Awards, for example, this past Sunday. And the whole Me Too movement and everything else. And then Kobe Bryant, the NBA player who was accused of rape, got an award. So there was a lot of people going on and on about that. I take no position on that. But the action has to absolutely follow the words. And that has to be on both sides. Women can't portray themselves as victims all the time, because we're not victims all the time. We are responsible for our own behavior. And when people do, like Harvey Weinstein does, or how some other men who I will not name that I've run across in my lifetime, when they behaved a certain way, we need to call them on them. If we're afraid of it, we need to get help. But what I worry about with these kinds of movements is that they increase the victimization of us as women, and that's a huge mistake. We should not be doing that.
Well, Lauren, thank you so much for your time. We've really learned so much through this chat, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners as well would love to get to know more about you and the work you're doing, especially considering that you're coming to India next month. So if our listeners want to get in touch with you, how can they go about doing that?
Well, I think the best way, I'm on Twitter. I am on I'm on all social media except YouTube, so it's easy to connect with me that way. Certainly that's an easy way. LinkedIn is good. Twitter is good. And I love to hear from people. If people have questions or want to challenge me on things, I love that too.
Wonderful, Lauren. This has really been amazing.
Well, thank you so much. It's been lovely getting to spend some time with the two of you, Ankita and Minal. And I look forward to the day that we meet in person.
Oh, sure.
We do too. Fingers crossed it happens soon.
I hope so too. I guess you'll both have to come back to India sometime in April while I'm there. Yeah. For that, I'll have to find a reason to go to Prague or go to the UK.
Oh, we're always happy to host our guests. So Lauren, anytime you want to come over, just let us know. And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in this week. We had a great conversation with Lauren. We learned a lot. We're sure that you did too.
And I'm sure it'll be interesting for our listeners based in India to learn that Lauren will be in India for more than 2 weeks in April to judge the Women Safety X Prize competition. So be sure to reach out to her. You can find her on social media. Like she said, she is on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, even on LinkedIn. You can find her at Lauren C. Anderson. And you can find us on social media as well at Desi Outsiders. We also would really appreciate it if you could go onto iTunes and leave a review for us, while also sending us your thoughts, comments, and feedback to mail@desioutsiders.com. So until next week, I'm Ankita.
And I'm Meenu.
And we are the Desi Outsiders. Yeah, I'm moving into a new place soon, so I have a second spare bedroom.
Lauren, she says this to every guest. Like, every guest knows that she has a spare room.
because right now, Lauren, you won't believe it, I'm sitting in my closet on the floor and recording. I finally get an office of my own, which is also a guest bedroom. So I'm so excited about it. I'm going to host all of my guests there.
Wow, well, you're going to have to get a huge place, or else you're going to have to set up a timeshare for spending time with you.